Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, flamboyant, risk-taking, two-all draw Kevin Day, and him, Liverpool University's reliable, practical 0-0 draw, Kieran Maguire. I was away on Sunday, Kieran. I missed our game. I was up in the North East Valley. I don't know if you've ever found out that your team has come back from 2-0 down whilst negotiating the clown's mouth on a crazy golf course.
But if you're the, I think a clown's mouth's from his Profanosaurus, actually.
Yes. I was going to say, if you're the family I startled near Whitley Bay on Sunday, I apologise. And the only reason Ali begged me to say crazy golf course in that sentence, because negotiating the clown's mouth would set you off. She knew that would set you off. and talking of your reliable, practical 0-0 draw, how was your pie, by the way? How was the guest pie?
It was excellent. For anybody that's going to be at the Amex this month, I heartily recommend the chicken and chorizo. very nice crust and extremely well seasoned. which is talks to me about a trip to Amsterdam, actually, but that's another story, of course.
I imagine the crust came after the trip to Amsterdam. Later in this episode, Kieran will be talking to Anthony Kaminskas, professional gambler and former manager at one of the country's biggest gambling sites. But first, we have some news stories, Kieran. And literally checked into the hotel on Sunday, and within 3 minutes was in a discussion with three middle-aged lady Newcastle fans who were having a high tea and went from quite posh to proper angry Geordie in the space of 5 minutes conversation with me about football. So it's rumbling, isn't it? It's rumbling under.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, where we are at present is that Mike Ashley's company, St. James's Holdings, had a competition assessment claim against the Premier League last Wednesday. Mm. And his argument is that the Premier League is making it difficult, stroke impossible, for him to sell the club to the preferred buyer, the Saudi Arabian PIF fund. And therefore, they were abusing their position. And I think part of the unhappiness, and I think this is shared by the Newcastle fan base, it's, you know, why if there is a dispute between Newcastle and the Premier League, why does this have to be held in secret? There are too many institutions, self-serving people on all parties. I'm not saying that the Premier League are the guilty party on this, but there's too much secrecy in general. So why shouldn't the arbitrations about the regulation of a club, and there's no commercial conflicts here. Why should that have to go through confidential arbitration? Mm. Surely the matters raised are of a wider interest to other clubs, to fans, and the general public. So the Premier League's argument is linked to their sale of a rights deal to in the Middle East to a Qatar-based broadcaster, Bein Sports, and I've been advised since we last spoke that relations between Saudi and Qatar are slightly thawed in the sense I believe that now you can watch in Saudi Bein Sports, so. It's messy. It does appear that the Premier League threatened to expel Newcastle United from the Premier League at one point as a result of these negotiations, which seems sort of petty. And trying to find out the exact reason for the continued delay and prevarication by the Premier League with regards to the sale of Newcastle. Let's face it, Mike Ashley has owned Newcastle for 14 years. He spent at least 10 of those years either quietly or loudly trying to sell the club. Mm. And yeah, it's like anything. If I'm selling my house, I don't spend money on it during that period I'm trying to flog it. And Newcastle United is now in a state of disrepair, with minimal spend by the owner as a consequence of it. And I'm certainly not defending Mike Ashley here, because his business practices are, it's what he does. But he's not the best thing for all parties is that he moves on, and Newcastle United move on. Now, whether that should be through PIF or somebody else, that's not for me to say. But it's very frustrating. And you spoke to three Newcastle fans yourself. There's this general sense of discontent, and they're getting a raw deal, and I think they are.
Well, the interesting thing, Kieran, is that Mike Ashley, deliberately or otherwise, and I guess deliberately, has deflected the discontent, because their anger was with the Premier League. And this is what I don't understand, and you can't answer these questions, Kieran, because of the exact privacy reasons you spoke about. But first of all, I can't think of any criteria by which the Premier League could expel Newcastle United, a privately owned company, for attempting to sell itself to another third party. I don't understand what the Premier League, or how the Premier League, who are, of course, the 19 other clubs, what possible basis have they got for stepping in? And secondly, as I tried to say to these nice ladies on Sunday, is it not possible that Mike Ashley is doing a smoke and mirrors trick here, because the Saudis simply don't want to buy a club that's been teetering on the edge of relegation for a couple of seasons? And yes, you can say, well, they didn't go down, so why didn't the Saudis buy them in the summer and spend another 500 million bringing Neymar and Messi in? But they don't want to do that, because then it doesn't look like the nice sporting football project that they want it to look like. So could it not just be that they don't like the product at the moment?
Well, they are prevented from acquiring Newcastle United by the Premier League, because to date, they have not satisfied the owners and directors test. And part of this competition claim is that, why have they not satisfied the owners and directors test? They've certainly got the resources. They can show the Premier League a bank account with more zeros than producer Guy has got. And there's not many people on the planet can do that.
Wow. Well, also, it can't just be reticence about their human rights record, because there are several clubs in the Premier League that you could throw the same accusation at.
Yeah, exactly. So, as you say, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors, I think, from Ashley. He is, deflect, try to play the victim card. Newcastle fans just want to say goodbye to him in as few words as possible. They want a future which they can have a bit of confidence and pride in, and I think that's part of the issue. They've lost that emotional love of the club, because it's difficult to love Mike Ashley's Newcastle United. Mm. They want to go back to loving the Newcastle United that they were brought up on as kids.
Mm. Elsewhere in the Premier League, Kieran, Watford's panic mode model of managerial mayhem has kicked in early this season. Claudio Ranieri has become the 14th manager since the Pozzo family took over the club in 2012. How much will this be costing them?
Well, the thing is, it doesn't cost them very much. I think what the what the Pozzo family have done, and by Watford standards, this isn't particularly far into a season before they kick somebody out. I think they have break clauses embedded within the contracts. It's not like Chelsea. I mean, Chelsea under Abramovich, if you go back to the accounts to 2005, they've spent around about 70 to 80 million pounds on payoffs to managers for apparently not being good enough, or alternatively, putting up some form of objection to interference in the way that they want to conduct themselves. So I think Watford are quite cute that they find managers who want the job, put them on 1 or 2 year contracts, and therefore when they get rid of them, there's not actually a large amount that they have to pay to buy the manager out, or they will say that when you sign a contract, you've got a maximum of 3 months pay or so on. I know that there was an article by David Ornstein in The Athletic on earlier this week saying something similar with regards to Nuno's contract at Spurs, in that if they don't make the top six, it'll actually be quite cheap to buy him out of the contract and get rid of him. But they can't afford Graham Potter, by the way, and he's rubbish.
You took the words out of my mouth there, Kieran. I mean, Watford's is sort of the same model as Chelsea, but is it bringing relatively the same level of success? I mean, Chelsea will point at a succession of paid-off managers, but also a succession of trophies. But Watford are the archetypal yo-yo club, aren't they?
Yeah, we had this discussion a few months ago. Chelsea have lost more money since the creation of the Premier League than any other club. So from a financial point of view, it's a very costly exercise for them. But if you are owned by an ultra high net worth individual such as Roman Abramovich, then it's chicken feed. So they will see it as the sporting success that has been brought, to Champions League success twice, winning the Premier League on occasions, and cup competitions. They say, well, that's always been our objective. We're not too worried about the financial side of things. And Chelsea these days actually operate a pretty good break-even model because they sell and loan so many young players out to other clubs, and that's actually proven to be a huge source of income since the arrival of EPPP. I think they've been one of the clubs which have really embraced it and exploited its financial advantages for them.
Just down the road, QPR fans won't thank me for putting them in that context, QPR have launched a bond to help build the club's new training ground.
Yes. This is effectively saying to fans, we're trying to operate on a more of a sustainable basis. The club owners have put money on in historically. It's going to cost around about £20 million for QPR's new training facilities. And they're trying to get around about a quarter of that from fans. So we talk about a bond. What is a bond? A bond is an IOU. Okay, it's a loan from fans. But it's going to pay interest at 5%. You'll also get an annual voucher to spend in the club shop, which will be worth around about 3% of what you lend to the club. And if QPR get promoted, you'll get a 25% bonus. So, on the face of it, it's a decent return, but it's an unsecured loan from the fans to the club. So if the club does have some form of financial distress, you do run the risk of losing all your money. And I think the club has tried to be as explicit as it can on this. So it's not something I would recommend to somebody that has little spare cash to play with. If you want to take it on, it comes at risk. As do all forms of investment. Norwich did similar a few years ago, and they paid out a bonus when they were promoted to the Premier League. AFC Wimbledon have the Dons bond, and that's been used to build facilities and infrastructure. So it does appear to be one of the ways that clubs are going these days, trying to say, well, if we go to a bank, a bank's going to charge us far more interest. So the club gets the benefit of paying less interest. The fans, if they want to, and if they can afford to, and if they are willing to take on the risk, will get potentially a higher return than sticking their money in just a bog standard ISA or something. Mm-hmm. But with a bog standard ISA, you're guaranteed to get your money back if even there's problems at the bank. So that's where we are. So I think it's an interesting approach. I don't think we as a show can either recommend it or not recommend it because we're not financial advisors. But all we'd say is that the returns appear attractive, but it comes at a risk in that it's unsecured lending. And my uncle Terry used to give unsecured lending. Mm-hmm. He would charge far more than 5%, but you know, even whilst it was lending was unsecured, he was always confident of getting his money back one way or the other.
I'm just intrigued by the fact you have to point out that I'm not a financial advisor. Just imagine somebody saying to their wife, saying, What's happened to that money? Well, there's this bloke called Kevin Day. I took some financial advice from him. I mean, I'm intrigued, Kieran, that they're launching this to fund the new training ground, because for the best part of the last decade, QPR have been talking about a new ground, and then they talked about the fact it was impossible to find somewhere to build a new ground in West London. And then Brentford built a new ground in West London in a short space of time. What's happened to the new ground? Can they not afford it now they're in a championship? Why is a training ground more important than the new actual facility to play on?
If you take a look at a football ground, at a stadium, it doesn't tend to raise a huge amount of money. Right. I think in the... in sort of the capacity level that QPR are looking at. You know, Brentford have gone from a ground which held, you know, what, 10, 11,000 to 17 or 18. So, yeah, that's a substantial increase. I think with QPR, and I love going to Loftus Road as an away fan.
Yeah.
It's again, proper old school ground. It is tightly hemmed in.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about that. There's no room for expansion, but I guess they feel that in terms of what is their natural fan base as a championship club, you know, if they went for a new ground with an extra 5,000 seats, are those 5,000 seats going to be filled? Yes, they would be in the Premier League, and this isn't a criticism of Queen's Park Rangers fans, because it's the same for any club in the championship. Yeah. You know, you're going to fill your empty seats in the Premier League, but getting there and staying there is pretty tough. And also, once you do get there, the vast majority of your money is coming from broadcast money anyway. So I think that they feel that they've got a history in recent years of really good development of young players. And you've signed SA, and he looks a fantastic player. And they feel that by having improved facilities, it's going to help their development model. And they see that player trading is a way forward for them, because there's a lot of talent in the vicinity of the club. You know, London's it's a big city. It's if you can get the kids in and develop them, then that's a way of generating additional revenues, which will be more productive than investing in a new stadium.
The competition watchdog has launched an investigation into Leicester City and JD Sports. I read the first part of that sentence yesterday and assumed they launched an investigation into how Leicester got a point at Sellers Park on Sunday. But no, it's an investigation into Leicester and JD Sports. It's an interesting one, this, Kieran. I did some rudimentary research late last night. What are the possible outcomes of this investigation?
Well, this is in respect of anti-competitive behaviour. Now, it's all very, very vague, but I suspect it's to do with merchandise and where can retailers access the merchandise. So if the view is that other retailers are unable to sell Leicester City shirts because they've got some form of tie-up with JD Sports, and on the back of that, it means that they are effectively able to charge higher prices. That would be anti-competitive, and it could result in one or both or either of the parties having to go and pay a proportion of their revenue as a fine. So, it's interesting as to where we are. That's my killing joke ringtone in the background, which I should very unprofessionally.
I guessed it wasn't Finley starting his own band, but yes. how many people recognise your when your phone goes when you're out and about? How many people go, "Oh, killing joke"? I haven't heard them for a while.
I think it's just me. That's a good thing. Yeah, nobody else is going to pick up the phone. Oh, what's that noise? Oh my! Most people have got fairly similar ringtones. Well, yeah, a bit of Jazz Coleman. So, who is? I mean, I've been to many, many gigs over the years. He is without doubt the scariest man I've ever seen front a band. So, in honor and he's a strange guy. You know, he emigrated to Iceland to write opera music. So anybody does that is got to be okay in my book.
Yeah. where were we with Leicester and JD Sport? This is not a legal issue, is it? This is just an internal Premier League competitive issue.
No. They will have been reported, presumably, by another retailer.
The competition
watchdog is a government agency.
I assumed this was a Premier League.
The Premier League doesn't get involved in the commercial side of things for individual clubs. So this will be a government watchdog who will be concerned about abuse of monopoly power. Now, it could be that both parties are completely innocent, but it's unusual that it's been brought into the public domain.
Mm. Aston Villa Supporters Trust, who we like the sound of, has condemned what it calls the club's wholly inappropriate agreement with Socios. Now, for the benefit of some of our listeners and 50% of our hosts, remind me what these are, Kieran.
Right, these are Aston Villa dollars. This company called Socios, what Villa have done is that they have said that every season ticket holder will be entitled to one Aston Villa dollar, which they'll be able to hold forever and can't be transferred. But it's also selling these coins, and you will be able to use your coins for enhanced engagement with your club, such as innovative polls, such as why on earth are we wasting our money on things like these, new club initiatives and real life and digital benefits. But it's all kept very, very vague. So I think the reason why the Supporters Trust call it wholly inappropriate is that these coins, they are backed by a cryptocurrency. And I think they fear that it's a gateway to being encouraged to trade. The real word for this here is gamble in respect of on cryptocurrencies. You will be able to buy some more of these Aston Villa dollars for £2 each, and then you'll be able to trade them on an active market. So lots of people will start to think of themselves as mini Gordon Geckos in the West Midlands, but it's very much an artificial market, and certainly one of the things I picked up when we had Gavin Brown on the show, who is probably the country's leading cryptocurrency expert in terms of knowledge of how it operates. These markets are open to abuse. So if you just want to get a couple of them and do a couple of polls, that's fine. And there's an argument for saying that it's just it's just another form of Panini card. And I think of how much money I spend trying to build up my Panini collections for some World Cups. I think probably was money wasted. But Panini, they didn't really go all in with the marketing and the commercial side of trying to persuade me to buy Panini cards. Whereas I think if the club is doing this, people who are not particularly financially aware of how these organizations operate could be suckered in and could end up handing across money which would be better used elsewhere.
Yeah, well, there's a quote from the Aston Villa Supporters Trust I want to come to. But first of all, Kieran, I will say two things. As a 12-year-old, Kieran Maguire, spending money on Panini stickers wasn't a waste of money because it brought you joy and pleasure. When you were still doing it at the age of 58 at the last World Cup, that was wasting money, Kieran. Without a doubt, that was wasting money. And secondly, just as proof that I can bear a grudge forever, you forgot to mention that Gavin Brown is also a chess cheat, which we established quite firmly when you were talking about him, when you were fanboying all over him last time he was on the... I think, This came out, and I like the fact that a supporters trust are holding their own club to account, because I think there are some supporters trusts who don't feel that's their role. It came out of the club announcing a vote on the new name for a road, or the name for a new road, I should say, commemorating the 1982 European Cup win, which is open only to those people who have Socios dollars, or have Aston Villa dollars. And the supporters trust said, well, why don't you ask the rest of the fans? Why is it only open to them? But they make the exact same point that you make. And this is only a slight paraphrase. They're saying what's happening here is that the club are exposing economically vulnerable fans to huge financial fluctuations in an unregulated cryptocurrency ecosystem. And it strikes me, Kieran, at a time, as we will discover in your interview, when the relationship with gambling in football was being questioned, this is flourishing. And it seems to be, as you say, gambling under a different name. And it's odd that the same clubs that are kind of having second thoughts about gambling companies on shirts are only too happy to adopt this. And I know Leeds fans were unhappy with their club doing it, and Villa fans are clearly unhappy doing it. It's hard to see what the benefit of it is.
Well, the benefit to the club is it gets more money. You know, it monetizes the fan base.
Right.
And it's purely a revenue-generating activity. And you know, the concern is that there are other clubs with more global fan bases who are starting to see this, because they're saying, you know, we've got X hundred million fans around the world, only 60,000 or 70,000 of them can get to a stadium once a fortnight. Let's engage with them. Well, you can engage with them, but in many ways you don't actually have to go and, you know, fleece them at the same time. So I've got reservations about things of this nature, because it is an unregulated market, because there is the opportunity for people who have large numbers of shares or large number of these cryptocurrencies to stack the market in their favor. It's the individual who tends to lose out.
Yeah, as you know, Kieran, producer Guy has this bizarre notion that we should reflect both sides of every story. I'm not entirely sure why. He keeps muttering something about, will it be me that goes to court? And I keep pointing out to him that he's got enough money to buy off any judge in the land, but he'll take that out. But on the basis that you should maybe reflect the sides of the story, you could argue that it's, in a way, it's only a glorified version of the Patreon system for podcasts. It's like, you know, we have patrons that pay an extra pound a month or whatever it is in the hope that they will get first dibs on the mugs when they come out. So in a sense, this is this seems to be a lot of money, a pound a month, to pay for the chance of getting a mug. But, you know, it is, in a sense, a glorified version of that, isn't it?
Yes, but, you know, what I would say is that we say to people on Patreon, A, there is a free alternative.
Yes,
that's true. You know, and we, you know, that we've always said that the show will be free to air, and we will not be putting on extra shows that you will get in advance or anything of that nature. B, it's not marketed as a form of investment. You know, it's effectively a subscription, a voluntary subscription to the show. There's no attempt to say that you're doing anything other than just, you know, supporting the show. And we're not trying to claim that you'll have potential financial advantages, or you will be able to engage with us to a greater extent, because, as you know, you know, we tend to reply to tweets and emails and, you know, people that contact us. I think on one of the Patreon levels you can get a shout, you can get a personalized shout out, and that's as far as it's going to go.
Can you? Who's doing the personalised shout outs? Go ahead.
You've done quite a few of them.
Have I?
Yes.
Oh, the things at the end of the pod. Oh, they're personalised shout out. Oh, I see. There's just me saying names at the end of the pod is a personal.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't realise that. Sorry. I thought you were creaming a little bit off the top by doing your own messages. What's that when celebrities charge 15 quid to say happy birthday? Cameo, whatever it is. Liverpool's costs for the Anfield Road development are likely to rise by £20 million. Now, in the current economic climate, Kieran, I don't know whether to say a whopping £20 million or only £20 million.
Well, it's a third increase on the initial estimate. So they were hoping to do it for £60 million. It would take the capacity at Anfield up to 61,000. And the good news, and you know, I've always said this, I work in the city of Liverpool. I love the city of Liverpool. But yeah, there's jobs that will be created. You know, you appreciate there are only, you know, match day jobs, but there's an extra 400 jobs going to arise on the back of this for people in the local area. So that's, you know, there are positives, but this is, you know, indicative of where we are in terms of that there's inflation in the construction industry. You know, wages are going up because you can't, it's more difficult to find tradesmen. Material costs are going up. And you know, that's you know, steel costs and so on, and on the back of that, FSG are going to have to stump up an extra 20 million quid. They will be confident of getting that money back. You know, the one thing I've learned about FSG is that they do they make my spreadsheets look a right amateur effort in terms of the degree of intricacy that they go into. But you know, they will be looking to get that money back. Yeah, you know, so hopefully that won't come through in the form of higher prices for tickets.
Yeah, they'll be hard to find 20 million quid. 20 million quid for them is the equivalent of when you put your winter coat on for the first time after nine months and you find three quid in the pocket. You think, oh, great. This 3 quid I didn't know I had. That's 20 million is roughly that 3 quid in the pocket of their winter coat, isn't it?
yes.
Southend United Supporters Trust has asked its members if they have confidence in the club's owner. I'm not entirely sure whether this was an email ask or just some blokes in the pub. But nevertheless, I would have put this after the previous question about Supporters Trust. But who am I to argue with producer guy's algorithms? also, Kieran, I won't lie. I went on the website of the Basildon, Canvey Island and Southend Echo to research this. But after it presented me with a short employment opportunity survey, then asked if I liked the new version of Blankety Blank, and then offered me an affordable loan, I gave up. I got involved in whether I liked the new version of Blankety Blank, obviously, thought about the affordable loan. I don't need a new job just quite now, but literally it was so far down the page, I decided that I'd had enough and MasterChef Australia was starting. So what's happening? Enlighten me, Kieran.
Well, Southend United are in the National League now under the ownership of Ron Martin.
Doesn't seem right somehow, does it?
Until they won on Tuesday night, they were in the bottom couple as well, given that Dover Athletic started the season on significantly negative points. They are struggling on the pitch. We don't know how bad the finances are because the owner, Ron Martin, refuses to publish accounts. There are no published accounts for 2020. So he's there. He has chosen to break company law. That's the only assumption that you can reach. But pre-COVID, the club was losing £50,000 a week, again, under his ownership. He wants to effectively bulldoze Roots Hall and move to a place called Fossett's Farm, which I'm the same as you. I go to all the grounds. I love a trip to Roots Hall.
Oh, it's great!
It's great.
it's one of the best away trips. Yeah, yeah. So it seems to me though, Kieran, that unfortunately, from his point of view, bulldozing Roots Hall is his only way out of this, isn't it? He's not going to escape with any money unless he develops the stadium further down the coast and turns it into a national venue for rock music and all sorts of other things.
Yeah, yeah, and that's his argument. You know, he says that the Roots Hall is it only earns money on 25 days a year. The new stadium will be more multifunctional. Is there a market for an entertainment venue in that part of Essex? You know, I grew up as a kid in Chelmsford, and you know, trip to Southend was my big day out. I'm not certain because, is it too close to London? You know, in that regard. So yeah, we'd have to wait and see.
Well, we could always build a new fun fair. So Shane Ritchie's got a job. Serie A champions Inter Milan have posted record losses of. And it feels like there should be a drum roll or the opposite of a drum roll for the €246 million, Kieran. That's a lot of money for the Italian champions to be losing, isn't it?
That is. And yes, COVID has impacted, but you know, COVID's not responsible for all 246 million of those losses. And you can see why the club is starting to try to get rid of some players. But it's half of the losses that were announced by Barcelona. And you know, Barcelona confirmed, I think in the last 48 hours, 481 million of losses. And you think, well, hold on, these are two clubs that were very keen on franchise league. I refuse to call it Super League. There's nothing super about it. It's nothing more than a franchise operation. And you can perhaps see why they were encouraged to set up this franchise operation, because it gave them guaranteed revenues. You know, they didn't have to win football matches to qualify for UEFA's competitions. Borussia Dortmund, who I love German football. I love Borussia Dortmund. I think they're a fantastic club. They announced large losses as well, but they were, and I hear say, only £72 million. They only lost a million and a quarter euros a week. But I think we are going to go through a year or two of clubs incurring big losses. Barcelona, however, are convinced that they're going to make a profit this year because they've shifted talent off the wage bill. But the losses within Europe are going to be huge. The clubs in the Premier League will be protected to an extent because of the success of the broadcast deals that they have, which are far larger than they are elsewhere in Europe.
Do you know what, Kieran? If this pod, God forbid, ever goes tits up, I'm going to start one called German Football, Russian Women, just so you and I can just still meet every week.
And then, that will be Patreon only.
Yes. And that very much subscription only, pictures on demand. In common with our theme of just down the road this week, just down the road from Italy, you'll find France. I sound like Alex Jones. And just down the road from Italy. No, it's more Geordie than Welsh, and a bloke. Definitely not a Welsh woman. That's a Geordie bloke. yes, France could support FIFA's plan for a two-yearly World Cup.
Yes, this is really weird because Didier Deschamps has said no to a World Cup.
We're full of accents this week, aren't we?
Aren't we? Who needs dead ringers?
I don't know why Didier Deschamps would say it like that. He'd say it in a French voice, wouldn't he, Robin? It sounds like Uncle Terry going, no.
Most countries in UEFA appear to be supporting UEFA's view that this is not good news. But the French football president, Noël Le Great. I'm not going to do any attempt at pronunciation now.
He was out of Asterix, wasn't he? No, yes. You're making that aim, Noël Le Great. Okay.
So the French president says, well, no, we need to investigate this further. We need to look at the considerations for clubs in other continents, you know, the African clubs, some of the Asian clubs and so on, and don't rule it out. And what also seemed to come out of it is that he seems to think that a Women's World Cup every 2 years should take place as well, because you know, most of the women's national teams have said, this is going to, you know, at a time of growth in the women's game, this is going to make it tougher for us to expand our audience. So if you've got a Women's World Cup every 2 years, you've got a Men's World Cup every 2 years, when's the Euros going to take place? There's going to be some clashes. This is all a political grab for, you know, as usual. It's all to do with power and money. This is between FIFA and UEFA. FIFA resents that UEFA is so successful financially in terms of both the Champions League and the European Championships. FIFA's World Cup is a fantastic competition. There's no denying that. It's expanding that competition to 40 clubs, so it's giving more clubs the opportunity to compete. So, it wants to do that twice as often. You and I are old enough to remember when it was 16 clubs every 4 years. Well, if if Infantino gets his way, there's going to be 80 clubs, 80 countries every 4 years. There's also the FIFA World Club Championship, which FIFA want to increase the profile of that competition on the back of the success of the Champions League. So it's all to do with money.
But also, as we've discussed here, it's all very well and laudable for FIFA to say we want to develop the game in Africa, in Asia. That's fine. That's great. That's how it should be. But as we've discussed ad infinitum on the pod, financially, the World Cup breaks most of the countries it takes place in. And so what you'll have is a World Cup here that increasingly will happen in those countries like Germany and France and Europe and America in general that have the infrastructure to support a World Cup. It's hard enough for countries to get plan a World Cup as it is, without having to do it at what is going to be shorter notice. So we'll keep it. We've got two more news stories, Kieran, which we'll mention now, but I think we'll probably develop further on our next pod or the one after that, because they're recently breaking stories. The first one, and I guarantee that 95% of our listeners, after I read out this story, will probably, and Kieran, I'm reluctant to swear on this pod, not in real life, but I'm guessing that after I say this, 95% of our listeners will go, cheeky fuckers, because the Premier League, that's my reaction. It's just like, I had to double check. I normally take guy's word on everything, including when the money's going to arrive. But I literally had to double check this on several reputable news sites. Clubs have called for the Premier League to create a £1 billion central lending fund in case they have the odd cash flow problem. It's like, what, really?
This is again a story we did pick up on, and the reason behind it is that the clubs in the Premier League have lost a fortune over the course of the last 12 to 18 months, and they are going to specialist lenders, the likes of Macquarie and Close Brothers and so on. And they are paying high rates of interest. I think Southampton are paying around about 9% on the money that they've borrowed. So what they want is for the Premier League to say, we can take some of the risk out of this and we will borrow money ourselves. And then we will lend it to the clubs. Because the reason why these lenders are charging 7, 8, 9% to clubs such as Southampton is because it comes with a risk of relegation. Now, given that the Premier League is always going to be there, the argument would be that the Premier League itself could borrow and then effectively become a bit like the bank of mum and dad to individual clubs. And this was a story I picked up from the Financial Times. So, clearly, it is a reputable organisation with a reputable journalist behind it. I can understand eyebrows being raised significantly upon hearing that news. Say, why don't you go and cut your costs a bit better?
Well, also, I can imagine those eyebrows will be raised even further in places like Bury and Macclesfield, where fans will be saying, how about a £1 billion central lending fund from which you could give us 30,000 quid, which would have saved our club? I'm really quite cross about this story, and I do want to develop it further. And the final story is that the owners of one club in particular, Man United, may not themselves be needing to borrow any money out of the £1 billion central lending fund.
That's correct. At 10 p.m. on Tuesday night, Manchester United announced to the markets that the two of the Glazer brothers, I think it's Kevin and Edward, are selling 9.5 million shares in the club, which will generate for them somewhere between $160 and $180 million. Now, none of this money goes to the club. This money will go purely to the shareholders. When it was announced, the markets in the US close at 9 o'clock. And when it was announced, which was an hour later, there is something called post-market trading or post-market price quotes. The price of Manchester United shares fell by 10%. Now, I suspect they will rebound a wee bit on the back of that. But it's further evidence that Manchester United has been very, very lucrative for some parties. And let's face it, let's include players and managers in this. Yeah, Manchester United do pay extremely well from a wages point of view. The owners have benefited. I think Avram Glazer sold some shares earlier this year, and he raised close on $100 million. The banks and shareholders have generated over $1 billion. But if you are if you're a journalist trying to report your copy from Old Trafford, expect rain and expect water dripping on your laptop, because the facilities at Old Trafford are frankly shabby.
Mm. As we know, Kieran, the relationship between football and the betting industry has become a huge discussion point recently. So you spoke to Anthony Kaminskas, someone who knows gambling from both sides.
Anthony, thanks so much for coming on the show. Yours is an interesting career path. Could you sort of, just for our listeners, sort of take us through how you've ended up where you are today?
Yeah, just don't really come from a family with any kind of gambling background, a real risk-averse family. I was always just naturally very good at maths, not so much your algebra side of things, but just basically mental arithmetic just always came very quickly to me. And I went to university, did economics. One of my lecturers was David Forrest, who's at Liverpool now with yourself.
I know David.
He's a very, very intelligent man. Just always good at maths, and kind of just once I graduated with my economics degree, it was just, what do I go and do? And just, I was obviously a massive sport fan. I always played football my whole life, watched football home and away games every single week, basically. And it was just trying to combine something with the maths that came easily to me with sport, essentially. And it's kind of what I fell into, just because everyone wants to make something for nothing, don't they, originally? And it drew my attention, and that's how I ended up getting involved in the gambling industry, basically.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Okay, so you were at one of the major gambling companies. That's Paddy Power. And so what was your role there?
So I started off in the risk team, which would have been horse racing risk, as basically a junior, graduated to a senior role in that. And then around halfway through, I think it was just prior to the merger with Betfair, that I basically took on Greyhound Racing. So I was in charge of Greyhound Racing for the whole company, be it retail, online. And then when we merged with Betfair, it became the exchange as well. Basically just ran Greyhound Racing for the Combine Group. And Greyhound Racing doesn't sound that exotic or that salubrious, but it would have been the third highest turnover sport in the whole company behind football and horse racing, basically. So it was quite a big role for somebody my age, basically.
Wow, yeah, absolutely. Now, you said that Greyhound Racing was third. So is football now the biggest player in the market from the gambling industry's perspective?
Yeah, 100%. It would have always traditionally been horse racing, and as you went online and your smartphones and everything, and basically as a new generation of people were born and turned 18, essentially, your horse racing customer tends to be a lot older. And I suppose, for want of a better phrase, they die out of over time, and the football has really taken over. So it's football is they're both very large sports, to be honest with you, but football would be the larger of the two.
Right. And I mean, yeah, I agree with you entirely. The ability to, yeah, if I go onto a gambling website, and you know, I don't gamble myself because as much as I like numbers as much as you do, but I'm completely risk averse. But there just seem to be so many alternative bets. Where is the money from the gambling company's point of view? You know, is it on individual matches? Is it on in-play bets? Is it on accumulators? You know, where do they see the what you might call the soft bets, where they can really make their money from punters?
Yeah, it's basically your mass market customer who will be spending 50 quid a week. Not huge amount of sums relatively to what these companies turn over, but they want millions of those customers basically. You know from yourself when you're in the stand when I used to watch football as a kid, you got the halftime scores over the tannoy. You don't get the half scores over the tannoy anymore. They're on your phone and people are tracking bets and running. That's one of the big differences I've noticed when I live in Dublin, but when I go home watching my team Rochdale. In the stand, everybody's checking their accumulator at halftime on the smartphone, and that's just the way things have developed. And that is the soft money. Football prices, especially in the higher grade football markets like Premier League, Championship, even your League Ones and League Twos, at the off, those prices are pretty accurate. Basically, it's very tough to beat starting prices in football; almost impossible on the high quality leagues. And then you've just got the customers in the stand that are doing accumulators. They're basically compounding a negative expected value bet by adding more selections to the bet. And the more selections to the bet, obviously you can win more money, but you're negatively compounding that bet by adding further selections, basically just based on opinion. You're not going to beat the bookmakers operating in that way, basically. And that's basically the way 99.9% of people operate. So that's why they're so big, essentially.
Right. And you clearly worked in horse racing and then Greyhound, and then you decided to poacher turn gamekeeper. You decided to go on the other side of the fence. What was the rationale behind that decision?
And the rationale, I suppose, was money. I was making more money gambling on the side than I was from my salary at the end. I was working really hard. I was working long hour weeks, basically because I was putting that much work into stuff I was doing outside my job to try and build something where I could leave my job and have the independence of working for myself. And it basically is just in and around gambling. I've basically betting professionally. I still am. And then adding different strands to that as well, be it obtaining bookmakers' licenses and doing things on that side myself as well at the moment, seeding markets for betting exchanges. I'm doing quite a lot of things at the moment. But yeah, it came from, I suppose, a desire for more free time. I started a family, spending more time with my family and basically not working for somebody else for a set salary and for set hours, basically.
Right. So in terms of a professional gambler, and I think Kevin mentioned this on the show of Sunday, I think there is a perception that a professional gambler will place one or two bets a month and do a lot of research into that and put in large sums and will effectively try to look for value in the market. Is that a right perception, or is I suspect there's far more sophistication in it than what how we see things?
Yeah, it's right in a way, but he's wrong about the bet count. So you'd be actually placing quite a lot of bets, but you're looking for, he is right that you're looking for the value. Everything's about value, basically. You're looking for something. It's the same in business. You're looking to buy a property for 100 grand that'll be worth 150 grand next year, sort of thing. It's you're looking for markets basically that are priced incorrectly by the bookmakers and taking advantage of those. So you basically, the way I operate is I don't look at bookmakers' prices. I set my own prices, which I've learned to do over for different sports over many years. And the accuracy of my prices then dictates whether I step into the market and bet something that I think is overpriced with a bookmaker. The advantage I have is that I don't have to have a bet. But when I do have a bet, I'm stepping into the market on a price that I think is incorrect, basically. And that's essentially how you win money over time. You're looking for incorrect prices. And basically, there's a lot of maths in it. There's a lot of computer work. It sounds, when people find out what I do for a living, it sounds quite glamorous and everything. But I can promise you, it's not. It's a lot of number crunching. It's a lot of data, and I enjoy it. Like, I don't find it. It's really nice to have something that you're doing that you, it doesn't feel like work, but it is work, the amount of time I'm putting into it. Like, I'll be doing my golf prices and up until into the early hours of mornings on Tuesdays and Wednesdays and things like that. So it's there's a lot of work goes into it, but finding the value is only half of the puzzle. The other half of the puzzle is being able to place your bets and find bookmakers willing to take your bets when you operate the way that I do, which is obviously another issue.
Yeah, I think when we spoke, myself, Kevin and I were talking on Sunday. There's this idea of a problem gambler. I would imagine from the betting industry's perspective, you are a problem gambler. Yeah, the people that lose aren't, but the people who can identify softness in, an incorrect pricing from their perspective. So, do they make it difficult for you to have accounts with them?
I don't have any betting accounts in my own name. They went a very, very long time ago. And it's not something that's that unique to me. It might sound abnormal to the people that are listening to the show, but it's actually relatively common. As soon as you are identified, the important distinction to make is it doesn't even matter if you're winning or losing money. Forget about results. It's all about, you'll be restricted by bookmakers if you are showing to be taking value prices. If you're betting horses at 3-1 in the morning and they start the race at 5-1 and they win, you can still place bets. If you bet horses at 5-1 in the morning and they start the race at 3-1 and lose, you cannot place bets. And it's based just basically on the whether you're accommodated by bookmakers is determined by your future expected value to them. And the way that future expected value is calculated is based on your business. It's based on how price sensitive you are. It's not based on a small sample of results, basically. So people that are accommodated by soft bookmakers like your Paddy Powers, your Bet365s, and they've had accounts for a while, they've still got their accounts because that bookmaker knows that even if they are ahead, it's like they're going to beat them, essentially. It's like if you go into a casino and you play roulette, you might have 10 spins and you might win one of your numbers and you get paid at 36-1 and you're winning. But that casino and that roulette table, they're not going to kick you out because they know that the mathematics is in their favor. Whereas if I was taking 36-1 about playing roulette and I knew for certain that black was going to be the color that the number fell in, I'd be immediately in good and You could play your numbers that way, and yeah, the maths is in your favor, and they don't want customers who put the maths in their favor, essentially.
Yeah, and that's always been my concern, that they are looking at all times to get punters to go into those markets where there is a guaranteed return for the bookmaker. So, encouraging them to go for the casinos, the slots, the bingo. And again, we're not talking huge amounts on individual bets, but it's guaranteed money. And I can therefore see why they would be worried about people such as yourself. So what you're effectively saying is that you are backing your professional judgment in terms of prices. You set your price, then you look for somebody that's going to be offering better odds than that, and therefore over a longer period of time, the odds are in your favour. And clearly, from their point of view, they want nothing to do with you.
That's basically it in a nutshell. Yeah, you're not. And my approach is you're not guaranteed to win as well. There's a lot about managing your bankroll correctly. You can take value prices all you like, but if they actually don't win, it's all about managing your bankroll and the systems to use around that, with like Kelly Criterion. If the viewers Google Kelly Criterion about bankroll management and things, the mathematical formulas to assist you in that way. Like I have losing weeks, I have losing months, I don't really have losing years, to be honest with you. But like over a small sample, you can lose in my job. And when it's your primary source of income or your income, essentially, you need to be winning over the long term. And yeah, like you say, the bookmakers don't want those guys.
I mean, the football industry, I think in the last 15 to 20 years, has become closer to the gambling industry. You know, I'm a Brighton fan. We know that our owner, Tony Bloom, is, again, a graduate. He's a maths graduate. He loves his numbers. We've got Matthew Benham at Brentford, and clearly there's the Coates family at Stoke. In terms of the first two, have they effectively done something similar to yourself in that they are professional gamblers? And you know, if it's 52-48 in your favour because you're using your mathematical as well as other knowledge to place bets, ultimately you're going to win in the long term.
Yeah, that's basically it. I'd love my name to be in the same sentence as Tony Bloom and Matthew Benham, to be honest with you. They are gods in my world, essentially. Brighton fans and Brentford fans can rest easy that the decision making at your clubs, and I'm sure they're well aware of it by the positions in the table at the moment. But the gambling people with my background knew what was going to happen to Brentford a long, long time ago. Just very, very intelligent, smart decision making. The Coates family at Stoke could be slightly different. They're basically a soft bookmaker. They've done soft bookmaking exceptionally well. You can question, and you definitely can question where some of that money comes from, given that they're a private company and they don't really publish what territories their money will be coming from, shall we say. I wouldn't be expecting Stoke City to do any pre-season tours of China anytime soon. Benham and Bloom are just different class, basically. They basically do what I do, but to a much larger scale and better, basically. Just they're the top boys, essentially, in the UK. Right. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Now, this has been absolutely fascinating. Yeah, I've just learned a lot in 15 minutes. But as well as being somebody involved in the gambling industry, you must be aware of what's happening in the world of politics.
Yeah.
Do you think that the relationship between football and gambling is going to change? And do you think it's right that some of the proposals from my point of view, if front of shirt sponsorship is banned, the major gambling companies in this country, that they'll be happy as can be because it's not actually affecting them. It's more to do with should we move further along the dial in terms of the amount of marketing, the soft marketing. I've been bombarded by texts and emails from a gambling institution since I just placed one bet as an experiment to find out what gambling was like. Do you think it's right that the government should be intervening, or ultimately it's just a harmless hobby for most people, and therefore government's being big brother?
Yeah, I think it's quite evident that self-regulation, basically self-regulation, hasn't really worked in the UK, and they've had more than enough time. I think what you find with gambling companies is they will do the bare minimum, what they can, basically what I used to do at school. You'll do the bare minimum to get by and get onto the next semester, essentially. I think a lot of the problems have come down to, I know you've discussed it yourselves with Football Index, just how weak the UK Gambling Commission is. They seem to be very focused on, I should be careful what I say because I'm trying to get a license on course with them at the moment, but you'd just be very, very, they're probably underfunded. There's probably good people at the UK Gambling Commission, and they've historically been very, very underfunded. And you're coming up against the Flutter Group that owns Paddy Power and Betfair is worth $40 billion now. You're coming up against Bet365, God knows how much money, you know what the salaries are like for Denise Coates, etc., how much money they're generating every single year. And if you're not policing those giants, you need to be almost a giant yourself and be someone to be scared of. And these massive, massive corporations have basically had the run of things for a very long time. Like the Flutter Group, which is Paddy Power, Betfair, Skybet, and a few other brands in the States and Australia and a few other different places, basically recently restricted under 25s, I think, to losing a maximum of £500 a month. And that is basically because they're just trying to, they're trying to show that they're doing something. No, it's quiet. And there was press releases around this and everybody saying, well, we think that the part of the brain of under 25s isn't developed to cope with these things. But what's telling about that announcement is it applies to the UK and Ireland only. It doesn't apply to all the brands in the world. So it's when they do things that are positive, like that is a positive step, it's just to placate regulators and governments in that territory. It's not for any altruistic reason, else they would apply it. I'm sure a 25-year-old's brain in Brazil develops at the same time as a 25-year-old's in the UK. But because in certain territories you're not being forced to look at things at this stage, we're seeing it in America at the moment. America is like expanding gambling legislation. It's all opening up in America, and you're seeing what was going on in the UK 6 or 7 years ago is basically just repeating in America at the moment. And that's kind of where the focus of these big brands is at the moment. It's in America. The UK is the most saturated gambling market in the world. Basically, there's not much growth left in the UK, and these firms, the time to police them adequately would have been 5 or 6 years ago. They're kind of leaving the UK behind now. They're kind of not. The UK is such a small part of their overall company at the moment, just given how Australia, America, territories in Africa and South America are now opening up. So, like, the UK has been saturated, and there's not much left for them. And they're applying the same things that happen in the UK in other parts of the world. And regulation is just further back down the line, and they can get away with what they were getting away with years ago in the UK with like VIPs and things like that. It's just, you cannot leave these companies to police themselves. They've tried it and it has been a catastrophic failure. And I think football is going to have an issue with Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies because they're going to be miles behind the curve on that. And I think you've spoken about that yourselves as well. And they'll just look for the next, they'll look for the next easy money to the detriment of fans and people like ourselves.
Good grief, that's quite damning and quite revealing. But it does sort of echo my reservations, and I think those of many others. Yeah, we've had people from the Big Step who have been on the wrong side of gambling, and presumably if you're restricted to losing £500 a week with £500 a month with Ladbrokes, you can also lose £500 a month with Paddy Power and £500 a month with William Hill, and punters will just, it's so easy to open an account and to run up, you know, losses in parallel, and there's no overall monitoring of the whole system.
That's right. Yeah, we get people like myself get our accounts closed down immediately, and the risk management tools are well able to deal with people like me in a prompt manner as soon as they spot me. The flip side of that coin is the people that have serious issues regarding controlling their spend, and they get away with things a lot longer. The source of funds, the money laundering regulations, they're immediately, as soon as I make a withdrawal on an account that's been closed, they're all over me. They want to see bank statements. They want to see who sent that money there. They want unredacted this. They want a picture of me holding my passport. They want absolutely everything to process a withdrawal once you're placing positive expected value bets. And the flip side of the coin is when you're exhibiting behavior that's going to put you in trouble, you get tickets to the big match and come and meet the players in this box, and it's poor.
Good grief. Well, you mentioned earlier that you're a fan of Rochdale,
the mighty Dale,
I've always had a soft spot for Dale because I say my favourite band, the Chameleons, are from Rochdale, and I'm seeing them twice in Manchester just before Christmas this year. As well as I used to on cricket tour room with the legendary Prowler, who is a huge Dale fan. So things at Dale, I think the perception amongst most fans was that they dodged a bullet in the summer and that everything was going fine. But you know, you're much closer to the club than I am. There's now rumours of Mount Southall buying 25% of the club. He had a meeting with the Rochdale Supporters Trust, I think it was last week online. Mm. You know, I read that and I didn't feel comfortable. What's your perception as a Dale fan?
Yeah, in the summer, I don't think we dodged a bullet. We dodged machine gun fire in the summer. I know you had Cole Cavanagh on. I know Cole from the Supporters Trust at Rochdale. What those guys did, they basically saved our football club in the summer. We've seen other clubs in our area. Listen, I grew up at high school. You grew up with a hatred of Bury Football Club. But my God, you'd love to go to an away game on a Friday night at Bury right now. Like, it's like what an absolute tragedy what happened to them was. Macclesfield as well was another great away day, great trip on an away terrace. Gone. Like, we've seen other clubs drop out of the league from around us. Your Halifaxes, your Scarboroughs, Wrexham. Like, we've seen loads of clubs around us disappear. And we've been punching way, way above our weight by having decent people in charge of the club and that weren't looking to make a few quid out of it. Matt Southall, or Southall, absolutely terrifies me. I wouldn't want him anywhere near the club. The Range Rover stories, the 10 grand a month apartments in London, like, the man is just, he's not going to fit in around Rochdale, basically. We don't want anyone making money out of the football club, basically. The football club is for the people of Rochdale, basically. It's an unbelievable football club. The people, everything about the football club is just done properly. We've never been in administration. Every club around us has been in administration. See what's going on at Oldham right now. It would not surprise me if Oldham went to the wall. Like, Oldham are in a really, really precarious situation. I think football fans in general, at our end of the spectrum, are just absolutely sick of it as well. These people coming in saying we're going to buy 25%, Matt Southall might be able to flip that and make 50% of it. Go and find another industry to pollute. Like, we don't want you anywhere near the football club.
Absolutely. I fully understand. And certainly that's the feedback I've had from fans at the Dale as well. I just want to say, Anthony, this has been one of the most fascinating interviews we've ever had on the show. And I really appreciate you giving up your time to come and have a chat with us. And I just want to wish you all the best for the future and stay safe.
Nice one, mate. Yeah, big fan of the show, and it's an absolute pleasure to speak to you and look forward to meeting you for a pint soon.
Excellent.
Kieran, I don't know if we should describe Anthony as poacher turned gamekeeper or gamekeeper turned poacher, but do you think, Kieran, that it's inevitable, after listening to what Anthony had to say, that gambling will soon follow cigarettes and alcohol as unacceptable bedfellows for football? And I'm aware of the irony that was a conversation I had only recently whilst drinking a pint at half time, watching my mate smoke out of the window.
I think the relationship will change potentially. Football has been really good for the gambling industry, and I'm not anti-gambling. My view is that some of the marketing practices of the industry are a cause for concern. I buy a lottery ticket each week, you know, and that's gambling. My mum and dad used to do the pools each week. Yeah. That's gambling.
Yeah.
And it was just a bit of harmless fun. But there are a proportion of people who have got into significant personal issues in terms of debt, domestic violence, depression, suicide on the back of the gambling industry and its practices. And my view is not that we shouldn't have gambling, but we should be doing more, or rather the industry should be doing more to protect the vulnerable. Anthony is a problem gambler for the gambling industry because he knows what he's doing. And you will see the adverts. Don't, and they say, don't chase your losses. Don't play. don't bet when you're emotional. If you're watching your football team, you're in an emotional frame of mind. So, you know, and people do, you know, they'll be watching their team on the box. And, you know, Bet365 used to claim a few years ago, it's all about the in-play. Why is it all about the in-play? Mm-hmm. Because that's when you make more stupid bets. And now, admittedly, they've stopped those adverts because they realise, actually, this doesn't look too clever. Mm-hmm. But I think it is indicative of an industry which could do better. And you know, I've received some very lengthy emails from people on both sides of the fence, and you know, your heart does go out to those people that have suffered as a result of the gambling industry. At the same time, as you rightly said, you know, people smoke, people drink, that should be socially acceptable. Mm. If people want to do these things, but we're at the wrong point on the dial.
Yeah, well, just yesterday we had a very lengthy Twitter story from somebody I obviously won't name, a pod listener who explained his problems, which essentially started from his football accumulator going down in the afternoon and deciding during the evening game that he wanted, you know, a minor thrill and maybe get a tenner back of the money he'd lost, and ended up losing a fortune on fixed odds gambling things on his phone.
Yeah, so it's the casinos and slots that really worry me because that's where the odds are really stacked in favour of the gambling institutions, and that's, you know, it's their insidious ways of trying to persuade you. But oh yeah, we'll give you 5 free spins, and then the next spin will cost you, you know, 20p, and you can do 10 of them in a minute, and yeah, that's 2 quid a minute, and that's 120 quid an hour, and so on.
Well, you know what Producer Guy would say? Producer Guy would say, if you've got a pound spare, don't put it on a horse. Go to patreon.com/priceoffootball and make a monthly contribution to our always free to air pod. Lots of you have done that, and we are very grateful. It's very kind of you. And if you have any questions for us on any aspect of football in any part of the world, at any level, it's questions@priceoffootball.com. And I shall leave you with Mr. Kieran McGuire for his customary farewell.
Well, thank you again for the feedback from recent shows. And, you know, we do take notice of the emails and the communications, and we do appreciate it as well. If you want to support the show, yeah, Patreon is one method, but you don't have to do that. If you just want good karma from us and our love and best wishes, just go on to that big purple icon for Apple. And if you can give us 5 stars, it does help the business side of things. Myself and Kevin don't know what the business side of things is, but Producer Guy does. And it's not for our ego. You could say you'd rather the show was delivered by Prince Charles and Joe Brand, and I for one, I'd probably pay for Patreon to do that for the price of football by our desperate to get to the throne monarch, and one of South London's finest. So apart from that, look after yourselves and love to all.
You know, Joe, of course, is a Palace fan, and Prince Charles has the demeanour of a Brighton fan, so that would be quite right. I bet Prince Charles loves a guest pie. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.